Airline Pilot Guy, Episode 136. Hello, you're listening to the Airline Pilot Guy Show, the view from my side of the cockpit door. I'm Captain Jeff, your host, broadcasting live from Studio 511 in the Marriott Hotel in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. In this episode, a helicopter drone near miss in New York, a passenger removed from a flight over Doodles, an update on the JetBlue engine failure and emergency at Long Beach, California, your feedback, and much, much more. So get all settled in, tray tables and seat backs in their upright and lock positions, electronic devices powered on. Flight 136 is ready for pushback. Hello and welcome again to the Airline Pilot Guy Show. My name is Captain Jeff. I am a line captain for a major U.S. airline, legacy airline. And once again, I find myself on a layover, this time in Kansas City, beautiful Kansas City. It's day two of a three-day trip, and it's a really nice trip. Last week, I had two three-day trips kind of back-to-back and ended up having to record, I think I recorded more than half of the show at home because I just ran out of time and ran out of steam. Well, this week, I feel much more rested because I only have one three-day trip this week. I might pick up some time between the end of this trip tomorrow and my next trip next week, but it's a nice trip. Three legs yesterday, ended up yesterday afternoon in Pensacola, and we stay at Pensacola Beach at a Holiday Inn Resort Hotel. Very nice location, beautiful weather everywhere we went so far on this trip. But anyway, had a great meal next to the hotel at the Sidelines Sports Grill or something like that. Had a great fresh blackened grouper sandwich. And it was kind of like a Philly cheesesteak sandwich with the blackened grouper on it. Oh, it was so good. And wasn't too early this morning to pick up, about 6 o'clock. And that's 6 o'clock Central Time. You know, I'm normally on Eastern Time. Flew from there to Atlanta. Again, beautiful weather, and then Atlanta to here. Little overcast, rainy when we got in here today, earlier today, but now I'm looking out the window and blue skies, and still, well, I'll call it broken cloud deck, but I do see some spots of blue sky above, and turning out to be a gorgeous day. Of course, it's almost over. It's about 4:14 p.m. Central Daylight Time. Got in a couple of hours ago and ate some lunch and did some more prep work for the show and had just hit the record button, obviously. So tomorrow, another easy day in the morning going from here to Detroit and then back to Atlanta. I'm finished, like midday. So really, really nice trip. And I love this time of year. The weather is starting to cool. The temperatures are starting to cool off. The air is feeling a little bit drier. A little bit of a breeze in the air. It's just a really, really nice weather here so far in the United States. So I'm enjoying flying on this trip. Let's see, what else? Oh, and then I know that many of you that listen to the show are in this Kansas City area. And again, I didn't think far enough ahead to say, hey, if you're in the Kansas City area, I'm going to be recording the show, but maybe later on, like late afternoon, early evening, we can meet at, let's say, the Flying Saucer or something like that. But I didn't. I didn't think of it again. I need to find somebody who can volunteer to do, okay, tell me, Jeff, what your schedule is, when you want to record the show, and if you want to have a meetup, and then I'll coordinate up everything for you. Oh, man, I'd love that. So if anybody out there thinks that might be their cup of tea, that'd be great. Oh, the other thing I wanted to mention, had a couple volunteers volunteer for doing the frequently asked questions, the FAQ, or I like to call it a FAQ, where many of you who have listened to the show over and over and over again know that I get a lot of the same questions over and over again because, you know, people all the time discover the show, and they start listening to the most current episode, or maybe go back a few episodes, but they don't go all the way back to the first episode. Now, I know some of you have, and you know, you're pretty hardcore, but most people don't do that. So they ask questions that have already been asked many times before. And so the goal of doing this FAQ, frequently asked questions, is to you know, cite the most frequently asked questions, and then either have text answers or audio, like a link to me talking about it on the show, like an audio excerpt, or a link to an audio excerpt, or both, whatever. And I know that's a daunting task, and I, as I said, I've already had a couple people volunteer to take this on, and I'm hoping that they've gotten together to work on this. But if you're interested in volunteering for that effort, just send me an email, whether you're interested in helping me coordinate meetups or if you're interested in working on this FAQ, send an email to me at jeff@airlinepilotguy.com. And in the subject line, put something like volunteer for something or other. And then I'll try to coordinate all that stuff, okay? What else? Oh, I got this from someone who wishes to remain anonymous, and I believe this is on my Facebook page. You can find that at facebook.com/airlinepilotguy. And he said, I work at an Air National Guard unit, and his unit has announced another pilot board. In other words, they're looking for some candidates for a flying position at this Air National Guard unit. And I'll tell you in a second here what the requirements are for this. But let me first say, I don't know when you're listening to this, hopefully within a day or two of me releasing it, because there's a very, very tight window here. The window is, let's see, you have to have everything in the application package no later than the 30th of September, which I think is Tuesday of next week. So I hope that if anybody is interested in something like this, that that they hear this and they can respond to it. I'll also I'll put out a tweet and a Facebook message or a Facebook post or whatever they call it, and then maybe anybody interested might see that and have a little bit more time to work on it. But anyway, right now it's Wednesday, and it's next Tuesday the deadline for this. This is what they need. Well, first of all, they're looking. It's a tanker position, a KC-135 tanker. I'm not going to say where. You'll have to contact me to figure out where it is. And this is for training dates in the fiscal year 2016. That starts October 2015 through the September 2016. Applicants must be college graduates prior to December 31st, 2014, this year. By the end of this year, you have to be a college graduate. And you should not reach age 30 prior to September of 2016. Individuals wanting to submit for this hiring board will need to submit an application package no later than the 30th of September, which I just mentioned. Okay, so what you need is a cover letter, a resume, college transcript, 3 letters of recommendation, a pilot license, which is not required for the application, flight time, AFOQT, TBAS, and PCSM pilot scores. Okay, I don't know what the last two are. I know what the AFOQT is. It's the Air Force Officer Qualification Training test. And you find your local recruiter and say, hey, I need to take an AFOQT. And then they'll tell you where you can go to take. And it's usually like a college that has an ROTC program. That's what I did when I was at Auburn. TBAS and PCSM, I don't know what those are. Number 8, current military physical, if applicable. I'm not sure what that means either. An Air Force Form 24, I don't know what that is either. You'll have to look this stuff up. And then miscellaneous, anything else you want to include that was not mentioned above. So there's a package here that has to come together. The most important thing that this person wanted me to say to you, if you're interested in this, seriously interested in this, is that you have to basically have a college degree already, not in college. Or if you are in college, you have to be finished by the end of this year. Okay? So you'll be in your last semester right now. So if none of that applies to you, then don't send me an email about this. So if you think that this might be something interesting, you want to fly a KC-135 for an Air National Guard unit. And if you are, if you have tanker or airlift experience, active duty experience, and you want to make the switch to the Guard, this might apply to you as well. Contact me, send me an email at jeff@airlinepilotguy.com, and in the subject line, put Air National Guard unit, okay? So that I know that you're looking for the link, the information on this, okay? So there we have it. Again, it's very, very time critical for you to respond to this if this is something that you're interested in. All right. Now, I was looking at some stuff. I'm not sure what I was looking for. I was on YouTube, and I happened to find this series with Bruce Dickinson, who was the front man for Iron Maiden, a heavy metal group. He did a show for Discovery UK, I think, called Flying Heavy Metal. And I think this is an episode 2. I'll play a little excerpt of this to, I thought it was a really pretty cool part of this second episode.
Over in Seattle, the Boeing Corporation wasn't going to be dictated to by any one government-owned customer. They had canvassed the entire American airline industry before forming the design of their next aircraft. Boeing, of course, understood that most of the runways in the world were only 5,000 feet in length, and if they could build an aeroplane that could get in and out of them with a full passenger load and full fuel, they would double the market for jet transport aeroplanes overnight. They came up with this, the Boeing 727, a T-tail and three engines at the back. Strikingly similar, in fact, to a Hawker Siddeley Trident. Two planes might look alike, but the Boeing had balls.
Well, if you want to watch more of that, great show. Maybe many of you have already seen this before. The first time I'd seen it was, you know, again, I don't remember what I was looking for. I was surfing the web looking for something else, and I kind of stumbled upon this Flying Heavy Metal with Bruce Dickinson. And, you know, honestly, I didn't know who Bruce Dickinson was. Apparently, not only is he associated with the heavy metal band Iron Maiden, but also is or was an airline pilot for an outfit in the UK, which I don't believe is there anymore. But anyway, it was a 757 pilot for them. And anyway, so I'll have a link to that in the show notes. I'm sure that many of you have probably know much more about him and this whole thing than I do, but I just thought that was pretty cool. And it shows him flying the 727 down in the Miami area, and it was pretty cool. I enjoyed watching it. Okay, excuse me. And let's see. Finally, it is time to talk about the coffee fund. The coffee fund. There we go.
Johnny, how much more coffee?
No, thanks.
I love coffee, I love tea, I love the Java Jive, and it loves me.
Coffee and tea and the Java and me. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup.
All right, so what the heck is the coffee fund? Well, that's the way for you to become more involved with the show by giving some money to me. Why, you say? Why would I be interested in doing that, Jeff? Well, this show, although free for all of you to listen to and watch, is not free for me. It costs money to do web hosting, costs money to do media hosting, etc., and equipment and all that kind of stuff. It just all, it adds up. So this is your way to, if you have the money to do that. Now, I've always said that if you're out there and you're a student, or if you're out there trying to save up your money to get flying lessons so you can get your experience to get a job out there in flying or whatever, no, I do not want your money. But if you are one of the listeners out there who happen to have some extra coins in your pocket and you want to donate, then I'd gladly accept. And you can do that by heading over to airlinepilotguy.com/coffee. And there you'll find a couple different ways to do that. And yeah, that's it. And of course, it helps me with funding my caffeine addiction. And coffee is my favorite caffeine delivery system. So thank you very much for your consideration. And this is, by the way, The Ink Spots, recorded in 1940, and the title of this is The Java Jive. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and have them fade out. Bye. All right. Now, guess what? It's time for the news. Okay, I briefly mentioned on the last show about that JetBlue flight that had an engine failure and smoke got into the cabin of the airplane, and they landed back at Long Beach safely. And then there was some confusion about whether or not there was going to be an evacuation. I think initially the captain decided that they would evacuate once they landed, obviously once they landed. And then I think he changed his mind. There was some kind of miscommunication there. Mentioning that the cabin was full of smoke from the engine overheating failure thing going on. And then when they got on the ground, or before they got on the ground, the flight attendants decided that it would be a good idea to have the oxygen masks deploy and for people to be pulling the actuator thing for these canisters, these O2 canisters, and putting them on their face and breathing this oxygen. And I mentioned that, no, you don't do that. That oxygen is not there for a smoke or a fire kind of a scenario. It's there for breathing when you lose pressurization. So you need that partial pressure of oxygen, et cetera. And I'm thinking, what in the world is going on? Are they teaching, you know, flight attendants out there to do this? And so that's when I appealed to my listeners who are also flight attendants, if they might be able to help out with this. And one of my new listeners, who is also a flight attendant, sent me some audio feedback. So thank you, Tyler, for doing that. So let's listen to what Tyler had to say.
Hey, Captain Jeff, just wanted to send you some audio feedback. Thank you so much for playing my audio feedback on the last episode. This is Tyler. I am a purser flight attendant. For those who do not know, pursers are some people call them cabin service directors, the A flight attendant, the number one flight attendant on wide body aircraft. I do fly international routes currently, so I get to do all the extra paperwork and divvy up crew rest breaks. But also, pursers are in charge of ensuring that emergency procedures are followed correctly during emergencies. I just wanted to bring up the JetBlue incident that you discussed in your last flight regarding the smoke in the cabin and the oxygen masks being down during that smoke in the cabin incident. So I pulled up my FAA manual, and I just wanted to read you our procedures when it comes to cabin fires and smoke in the cabin, things like that. There's an interesting little blip here that says, warning, O2 walkarounds in cabin PSU masks are not to be used during cabin smoke emergencies. Masks allow ambient air or smoke to be mixed in with the oxygen, which is exactly what you had said before. A PBE, which is an inflatable mask that goes around the flight attendant's head, helps us fight fires, is the only protective breathing device used in a cabin smoke emergencies. If you look at step number 3 in my manual, it also states that remove oxygen, solid state oxygen canisters, O2 walk-around canisters from the immediate area, as this is a massive fire danger, including the PSU masks. Massive fire danger with that oxygen. It's not pure oxygen, like you said before. but the oxygen that's flowing is there is very dangerous. So no disrespect to the JetBlue flight attendants, but coming from a legacy U.S. carrier, our policies are completely the opposite of what happened there. I'm not sure what kind of aircraft they're on. I'm assuming JetBlue, it's got to be somewhere in the A320 family, maybe even an Embraer 190. I forgot to look, so I apologize. I think it's, I don't know, you'll let me know. But the Airbus aircraft that they was on, I'm not sure how they could have turned on the PSU mask from the cabin. I don't have any recollection. I am trained on the A321 as well as the A319. I don't have any recollection of us being able to turn on the oxygen masks at that point. They could have requested the pilots to do so, although I'm not sure the pilots would have recommended that. But anyways, we're not here to judge. We'll let that all pan out as it goes on. They did a great job evacuating the aircraft, and I applaud them for that. That's what cabin crew are there for, to ensure the safety of all the passengers on board the aircraft. So, I just wanted to give you my little tidbit from that, from another flight attendant's perspective that is completely against what we're supposed to do. I've only got about 15 seconds left on this 3-minute recording that I can send you, but I just wanted to say thanks and clear skies and happy tailwinds to you. Oh, Captain Jeff, just wanted to add this as well. In my last audio feedback that I just sent a couple minutes ago, I stated that I wasn't sure how they could have manually opened the oxygen mask in the cabin, and totally slipped my brain, and I'm sure my flight attendant instructors would kind of slap me up against the head if they heard me say that I wasn't sure how. There is a MRT, or a manual release tour, that is located under every flight attendant's jump seat, and basically there's a pinhole-sized pinhole-sized little button that is on each passenger service unit that you can stick the MRT into there, and that will manually release the oxygen masks in the unlikely event that if there was a loss of cabin pressure and the mask didn't drop. So that is in place for that procedure. I apologize for not adding that to you before, but if you could just add this at the end or something like that to make it a little easier for everybody to understand, that would be great. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you, Tyler, for sending me that audio feedback, and I played both of them back to back there. And again, I can only guess that there must have been some kind of panic going on there and confusion, perhaps a miscommunication from the cockpit to the cabin crew. I don't know, but clearly that was not the right thing to do. So, and I don't have any other information regarding that. So if we hear anything else in the future, we'll definitely talk about it. So thanks again, Tyler, for taking the time out to send me the audio feedback. I really appreciate that. Let's see. A New York Police Department helicopter and a drone in a near-miss incident over Brooklyn. This is from the New York Post. The New York Police Department chopper almost got hit by a DJI Phantom 2 quadcopter drone around 1 o'clock in the morning on Wednesday of last week. The New York Police Department helicopter was at 800 feet in the air and almost hit the drone. They had to alter course to prevent hitting the drone. Again, they were at 800 feet, and I guess the drone was too. The 83rd Precinct was notified, and Isaac Rosa, 34 years old, was arrested for illegally operating the remote-controlled DJI Phantom 2 quadcopter equipped with a GoPro camera. Law enforcement officials said these drones pose a safety threat to aircraft and the people on board because the pilots do not know they are in the flight pattern. Rosa, who lives nearby on Central Avenue, was arrested on reckless endangerment and obstructing governmental administration charges, whatever that means. He was arraigned in Brooklyn at the Brooklyn Criminal Court last night. This was a few days ago. And released on $1,500 bail. He denied that flying his drone was against the law. I'm very disappointed. They are trying to make an example out of me, he said. At the end of the day, this is not an illegal activity. On Sunday, he posted a 16-second video on Facebook showing elevated shots of Coney Island and the Wonder Wheel, clearly recorded by a drone, which is against FAA rules. Rosa wrote in his post on Facebook, "I think I'm getting the hang of this." The FAA could bring additional charges against Rosa for flying the unmanned aircraft near LaGuardia Airport, which is 5 miles away, and in prohibited Class B airspace. Under the FAA's model aircraft guidelines, the tiny remote-controlled machines must not interfere with manned aircraft or fly within 5 miles of an airport without prior notification. The FAA has said they are investigating a report that a small unmanned aircraft system was flying approximately 5 miles south of LaGuardia Airport at 12:45 in the morning. And then it goes on to talk about the FAA planning to introduce new laws regarding drone use later this year, blah, 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 blah. So there we go. You know, it's just a matter of time before one of our airplanes hits one of these things and it causes a major problem. So I think it's just going to be education to the people out there in the world that don't keep up, you know, don't listen to aviation shows or UAV Digest or any of these other shows. And they don't know the rules. They don't know that they're not supposed to be, they don't know that they're supposed to be flying the drone below 400 feet and not within a certain distance of an airport, et cetera, et cetera. So hopefully, you know, more people will become educated and not do these foolish things. All right, let's see. Oh, this is kind of cute. Oh, such a cute little robot. A tiny humanoid robot learning to fly real airplanes. Well, not really. As much trouble, and where is this from? It's from spectrum.ieee.org. IEEE, okay. As much trouble as humanoid robots are to build and control, we keep on trying to make it work because it's easiest to operate in a human environment if you can do the same things that a human can. There are some good arguments for why it makes a lot more sense to modify our environment to better suit robots, but the fact is, if you can pull it off, humanoid is still the best way to go, even for flying airplanes. Not. If this sounds crazy to you, it sounded crazy to us too until we saw it basically working at the IROS presentation. I'm not sure what that is, sorry. The little robot in the picture above is a PIBOT, or a PIBOT, P-I-B-O-T, a small, very low-cost humanoid, actually a Bioloid premium from Robotis. It's been slightly modified to be able to work with the controls of a scaled-down simulated aircraft cockpit. PIBOT is able to identify and use all of the buttons and switches and stuff that you'd find in the cockpit of a normal light aircraft designed for humans. And it goes on to talk about it, flying the simulated airplane, blah, 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 blah. There's so much more to, you know, I get so, yeah. I listen to a lot of tech shows and I know, you know, I listen to them. I know they're credible when it comes to technology. But when they start talking about things like technology and airplanes and piloting and that kind of thing, it's just like they are just like anybody else out there, you know, thinking that these, I was watching a show and these two tech geek ladies were talking and they say, well, you know, the airplanes just basically fly themselves anyway. Well, no, they don't basically just fly themselves. I wish that the people that say that kind of thing could go up and see, come in one of these really highly automated airplanes and sit in the jump seat and watch what we're doing up there. We're doing a lot of stuff. These things don't just do everything on their own. We kind of manage a lot of these auto flight systems ourselves, but it's a very highly choreographed ballet we're doing up there to get everything to work together and again to provide a nice smooth flight for you, the passenger, et cetera. And we're not, you know, it's not, we don't hit, again, we don't hit a button that says take off and we sit back and watch the airplane fly and then, you know, land. And no, if it were that easy, then yeah, you wouldn't have to have such highly qualified people to do this job. I don't understand it. I could probably find a sound clip to play that would, well, here's one.
I have very little patience for stupidity.
I know. I really do. Okay. And it's actually not stupidity. It's really just ignorance. And I don't mean that ignorance in a bad way, because ignorance is, you know, I'm ignorant in a lot of things. Things that I know nothing of because I've not been trained in it or schooled in it or whatever. Okay. So I'm ignorant in many, many things. So that's not necessarily a bad thing, but let's start talking. When you're talking about things like on a tech-related show, and you really don't know, then don't say it. Please. Okay. Passenger ejected from a flight over notebook doodles. A Melbourne man was hauled off a Tiger Airways flight by federal police on Saturday after claims he was seen doodling and writing sentences in a notebook, satirizing the current terrorism threat. The incident has highlighted the growing sensitivity among officialdom and the public following the decision of the Abbott government to raise the national threat level, and a series of raids were staged against alleged homegrown Islamic fundamentalist terrorists linked to the Islamic State movement. This is down under here. Oliver Buckworth, 28 years old, claims he was removed from a Gold Coast bound flight after a fellow passenger saw the contents of his notebook over his shoulder and informed Tiger staff. And he says, "The irony is I was writing a sentence about the absurdity of the fear-mongering when we live in such a happy country of ice cream and beaches and fluffy things." A page of Mr. Buckworth's notebook seen by Fairfax Media contains the sentence, quote, "In a land of melting ice creams, sandy feet, and fluffy bears, how could anyone be fearful of terrorism?" And other doodles include a sketch of a chandelier. He's a interior designer. And the play on words, terrorism is made up. Cartoon of a child clutching his head. Mr. Buckworth wrote in a thought bubble, "Tyrannosaurus rex, pterodactyl, tarantula, terrorist." Mr. Buckworth said a neighboring passenger told a flight attendant, "Look what he's writing." I turned to him and said, "Yes, look what I'm writing. Read the whole sentence. I'm just writing some notes." But apparently, Tiger Airways staff notified the Australian Federal Police, who offloaded Mr. Buckworth. After being interviewed and undergoing a background check, Mr. Buckworth was released. So, yeah, we got to be careful about these things. I know that people are, you know, kind of aware of all the terrorist stuff going on around us, but let's don't overdo it, okay? All right, let's see. Is that it? Yeah, not a lot of news going on, which is good. That means that it is time for us to proceed with the best part of the show, your feedback.
Captain, incoming message.
Okay, let's start off with Mr. Rick in Miami. And he sent me some audio feedback, actually a couple pieces of audio feedback. We're going to play them back to back. Here we go.
Hey, Captain Jeff, it's Rick again from Miami. On the flight back from Amsterdam to Sao Paulo in Brazil. I was just listening to episode 130, and I just wanted to compliment your answer to Max's question about the use of a single-engine thrust reverser on landing, you know, when a thrust reverser is either deactivated or you've had an engine issue, which, you know, leaves that affected thrust reverser out of the equation. So yeah, a lot of times, as you said, for maintenance reasons or, you know, A, B, or C, you might only have a single thrust reverser available to you. And on the plane that I fly now, the engines are wing mounted. And as soon as you touch down, you will obviously use the thrust reverser that you have available to you. And being that the engines are wing mounted on this airplane, then you will feel a bit more yaw than I imagine you would feel on your Mad Dog. And now, you know, obviously we just counteract that with rudder. You know, you have enough rudder authority to keep you tracking down the center line. The rudder on this plane, on the 777, and I believe it was the same with the 76, is effective down to about 85 knots. And then below that, you got 7 degrees of nose wheel steering to keep you down the center line. So, you know, just touch down, apply thrust reverser, keep it tracking down center line with your rudder, derotate as soon as practicable. And then what I do, if you know, on the times that I've had that happen to me, you know, just having a single thrust reverser, just derotate, and then give it a little bit of nose down elevator to make that nose wheel steering a bit more effective. And then as far as the differential braking, I believe Max's question, well, at least that's how I understood it. I thought Max's question was whether you can use differential braking with the auto brake engaged. And if that was the question, then the answer would be no, because if you touch the brake pedals, you know, the top portions of the rudder pedals, if you touch them, then you will disengage the auto brakes. Now, there's different ways of disengaging the auto brakes. On my plane, you can tap the brakes, that'll disengage them, or you can obviously, you know, turn the knob to the off position, you can move the speed brake lever to the down position, and all these things will disengage the auto brakes. But if you want to use differential braking, just the fact that you're pushing the brakes, it'll, you know, disengage them. And you, from that point on, you're using manual braking, be it both brakes together or differential braking right and left. So that's my two cents on that. Hope you're doing great. Great show. Keep coming, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Rick. And here's his second one. Thank you for helping me or clarify the answer that I gave regarding thrust reverse on a single engine situation and differential braking. And here we go. Here's your second one.
Hey, Captain Jeff. Rick again.
Hey.
You're probably going to start getting sick of me leaving so much feedback with you. But
No.
I'd start leaving feedback, so here it is.
Okay.
Made it to Brazil on the layover here, and we're going to head back to Miami tomorrow night sometime. So it's going to be an interesting flight. We're going to go through Rio de Janeiro, then through Quito, Ecuador, which is one of my favorite approaches in the world. Great, great airport. Amazing approach. Nestled in the mountains. Runway's up at 7,000 feet, so it's pretty interesting. And then on to Miami, which is always great because that means I'm back home. So, but anyway, I was listening to episode 129, maybe? Or, yeah, 129 or 130. And Nick asked a question about pitch up moment upon landing that you get when auto speed brakes, ground spoilers, deploy. And, well, that happens in the big planes, too. I don't know about the Mad Dog, but on the 76, I remember, it was actually, you had to be really careful with that, because if you had, if you weren't careful with it, I mean, as soon as you touched down, the spoilers would, you know, deploy on main gear spin-up. And then the nose would pitch up. And then you would aggravate the situation by deploying thrust reverser. And then a lot of people would overcorrect and actually introduce a nose-down elevator command. And then they'd end up cracking the fuselage. And if you look at the statistics, the 767 has the highest number of fuselage, I guess you'd call them fuselage, what would you call them? You know, when you derotate too fast and then, you know, the nose touches down too hard and you end up buckling the fuselage.
Boo-boo.
I believe there was a video, it was a Japanese ANA 767 that did that, and there's it happened in Miami, I know that for a fact. It was a Bolivian passenger airline, I forget what it was called, but they did that in Miami. It was there's a couple of Alitalia 767s that did that too. So you really have to be careful with that. I remember one time landing in Quito, interestingly enough, the old Quito airport, which sat up about 2,000 feet higher than the airport now. The old Quito airport sat up at 9,300 feet. So your true airspeed and your ground speed were considerably high on final approach. And I remember the auto speed brake system was deferred. And we would touch down. And as soon as I touched down, I deployed the speed brakes manually. And I did it a little bit too fast. I should have actually done it at the same rate as the auto speed brake system does it. But I just figured, you know, I'm on the ground. I need to get the lift up from the wings. And I deployed it a bit too fast. Oh, my food is here. Thank you. Oh, that looks delicious. Thank you very much. And I just felt the nose of the airplane. I felt the nose of the airplane just go up, and I was tempted to give it a bit more nose down elevator than I. Well, I almost basically got to a position where it could have gotten messy, but it didn't. And now on the 777, as soon as you touch down, not all the spoilers come up. Actually, certain spoiler pairs come up first to avoid that nose up pitch moment. And then once the nose is derotated past a certain angle, then the rest of the spoilers come up, and then that you don't really feel that nose up moment anymore. So that's my two cents on that. My steak is here. I'm having a nice Brazilian Antarctica Malz beer, which is a sweet, dark beer, delicious. And that's great, because I got more than 24 hours here, so I'm good to go. All right, Captain Jeff, hope you're doing great, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sweet. Sounds good. I was going to ask you what you had to eat there. Again, thank you for sending the feedback and further illustrating how wonderful that 777 is, all the great systems on it and spoiler deployment. Again, the L1011, I've talked about that many times in the past, also had a very sophisticated way of deploying the spoilers when landing. And anyway, so we're not going to get into that on this show. So again, thank you, Rick, for helping me answer those questions, and thanks for listening. Do appreciate you being out there. Janelle writes, thought I'd share some YouTube geekery at its finest. I've never been in a plane when visibility was this low, but this must have a serious pucker factor. Pardon the phrase, but seriously, yikes. I guess the minimums for a 747 are pretty dang low. Hope you had a great staycation. I did. Thank you, Janelle. And she sent me a link to this YouTube video, which I'll have in the show notes if you want to look at it. It has a bunch of airplanes flying in the fog. And yeah, we can, you know, most modern airplanes now are category 3 capable, which means either hardly any visibility at all, or in my airplane, we have to see something by 50 feet, but that's pretty darn close to the runway by that point. So it's almost, not quite 0-0, but it's getting pretty low. So yeah, these airplanes, when the autoland systems are used, can do pretty amazing things. But just in case you didn't know, we don't normally like the airplane to land itself, the autoland system. In general, it makes us uncomfortable. You know, we like being at the controls and actually actuating the controls for a landing. It must be a control thing, you know, we pilots. Anyway, let's see. And then she also sent me another note from her iPhone. Looks like the coffee fund is going to need a little extra padding in 2015. And then she sent a link to this article that says beer prices are likely to be impacted by rain damage to malt barley crop in Montana, North Dakota, and Idaho. This August, we here in the U.S. For these states had drenching rains, which caused much of the malt barley crop to sprout early, making it useless for brewing. We've been told to expect major price increases for malt, according to Tim Moore of Angry Hank's Brewery in Billings, Montana. There is no panic yet. Everybody has been telling us not to panic. There is a carryover from last year's malt supply. Our prices are stable until January, but beer prices are going up. And let's see. It wasn't the amount of rain that these three states received, but the timing of it. And brewing is a very specific process in which dry malt barley kernels are sprouted precisely at the right time during the malting process to produce the sugar base that makes up alcohol. Once a kernel starts to sprout, the process cannot be reversed. And in this case, the early rains in August, right about the time that they were starting the harvest, the stuff that they harvested, of course, is safe, but the stuff that was still out there left unharvested and then getting the rain basically caused the grain to sprout, and that's not good. So that pretty much meant that anything that had not been harvested was ruined. So sadly, that means that the price of malted barley is going to go up, which indirectly will affect the price of beer in the future. Not good. Thank you, Janelle, for that wonderful news. Bill Kempthorne writes, this is take two for me. He tried sound pipe with not too much luck. And so he decided to go ahead and record. I don't know if he did it on his phone or something else, but he attached an MP3 file and sent it to me via email, which is a great way to do it. So thank you, Bill, for doing that. Here, let's listen to what he has to say.
Greetings, Captain Jeff. This is listener Bill from Victoria. After APG 134 and your discussion of hypoxia, I had a really interesting flight the other day dealing with a controller. Very much like the second story on your example where a controller talks somebody through, I had a situation when I was talking to one of our terminal controllers, and he was working another aircraft that was practicing some IFR approaches near a nearby airport. The controller was asked to provide them a hold over some fix, which he did. And then shortly thereafter, the aircraft canceled the hold and asked for a straight-in approach, stating that they had some kind of problem with the aircraft. He asked them, are you in need of any assistance? And they said no, and he cleared them for the approach as requested. And a couple minutes later, he comes on the radio, and it was almost like he had been listening to the same episode and said, just to be clear, is everything all right? And the pilot replied, everything was fine. He said, well, I need to know for sure that you're not declaring any kind of emergency. And the pilot confirmed that there wasn't anything to require that. In retrospect, they were probably having a problem setting up the hold in the autopilot or their navigation system, and they just left that part of the training they were doing. But it's always nice to see that the controllers do watch out for us. And very much like what you said on APG 134, I totally do not believe that you can hang whatever happens in a hypoxic or other aircraft situation on the controller who's there to help when asked and do what they can. And in this certain case, to the Victoria terminal controller who is watching out for that pilot someday and all the other controllers, job well done. And again, thanks for the excellent podcast. Fair skies and cavalcade weather. Thanks very much. Bye.
Thank you, Bill. And that's applause for the controllers up there in Victoria. Job well done. Kind of keeping their eye on us. Sounds like it worked out well. Great communications there and follow-up by the controller. Let's see. Phil writes, this is my first feedback, but I've been listening for a while now. Where you been, Phil? I was just listening to episode 134 on my iPod, tilling my front yard in prep for winter rye, and I thought of this. I'm not sure if you've already covered this, but I was curious about what you thought about some of the pilot mills that are popping up, places like ATP, Airline Transport Professionals, that offer ab initio 0 to ATP certification in 6 months, plus or minus. Now, I've graduated with a bachelor's degree, and I've wanted to be a pilot ever since space camp, 20 years ago. I'm now 29. The downside to the above is the barrier to entry is quite a huge one. The 0 to ATP cost is roughly $60,000 U.S. dollars. Even some of the collegiate programs cost nearly the same price. Actually, some are more. I'm currently looking at UVU in Orem, Utah, south of Salt Lake City. The upside, I think, would be that since many of the first officers will be moving up the ranks after the baby boomers retire, there should be plenty of spots opening in the regional and smaller airlines for those fresh out of the mill. True. So, with the above in mind, do you think that since the price tag is so high and this profession is being profession being such a gamble these days, that something like the Zero to Hero would be a gamble worth taking, as it may place one in a position to take advantage of the shift in available pilots? Sorry about the length, if you've already tackled this topic once before. Yeah, I've talked about it a few times. And this is an example of a question that we'd probably put in a FAQ. But Phil, for you, we're going to talk about it one more time. So he said, I just decided to come inside, watch the video version of episode 134. I figured the winter rye can wait. APG is on. Thank you, Phil, from Texas. So, Well, you know, a lot of things to consider, Phil. You're right that I think that somebody getting into the system now, it would be a good thing if they understood that it may be some time before they actually will get the experience necessary and the spots open up in the majors. So you could be kind of stuck at a lower pay rate for a while, flying some pretty hectic schedules. That is definitely doable. You know, you're young, 29 years old. I was 30 when I was hired by ACME. Of course, that was after 7.5 years of military flying. And so I had all my qualifications to get on with ACME. And that was 26 years ago, and here I am. But a little bit different situation for you, going from zero to ATP. And it's more than just going through this pilot mill thing. It's after that, you know, you're going to come out of there with, what, 300 hours or something? You know, less than 500 hours of time. You're going to need to get another 1,000 hours or so or more to meet the minimum requirement to get on with a regional. So you're going to be out there flight instructing for, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years, maybe. You're not going to be home a lot because you're going to be flying all the time, and you're going to be not making a heck of a lot of money. And, you know, are you married? Do you have children? You know, these are all things to consider. So, yes, doable. Is it for you? I don't know. Depends on how badly you want to do the job. But if you have the will, there's a way, and the future looks good for this kind of move. But again, there's so many variables that I can't really tackle all at once that you have to consider. So I welcome anybody else's comment out there. I know that people are saying, look, the pilot mills are just, you know, out there to get your money. It's you're not going to be anywhere near qualified to get on with anybody at that point. Some people would say, yeah, stay away from the mills, go to the university, and at least you have a degree, and maybe you can use that degree for something if you don't get a job as a pilot, et cetera. So a lot of things to consider, Phil, and I'm sorry I can't really say yes, Phil. Forget about that winter rye and go immediately to ATP and sign up and start your training, because you'll definitely get a job with this regional airline, and then, you know, 5-10 years from now, you're going to be flying for United, American, Delta, whatever, and making more money than you know what to do with. That's not true. So anyway, that's about as good as I can do for you. Okay. Hope that satisfies you. And again, if anybody out there wants to kind of chime in, please do. Mike Cochran, he's our law enforcement helicopter pilot out there. He sent me a link, and he goes, have you seen this one yet? And so I said, what? What is this all about? The name of this is passengershaming.com. And I didn't set it up, so let me go here. And it basically redirects to a Facebook page. And it's brought to you by The Rants of a Sassy Stew. And it's a Facebook page that shows pictures of very, very bad passenger behavior. You may not want to look at this before eating. Oh, my goodness. This is a picture of an airport lavatory, a bathroom, and it, it's pretty disgusting. I'll just let you look for yourself. How about that? Shaming. I think I said sharing. What I meant to say was passengershaming.com. And, you can take a look there yourself if you want. So thank you. I thank Michael for sending that to me. Vlad writes, this is via Facebook. Hey, Jeff, I'm a 20-year-old aspiring pilot, and I believe I will become one. But I'm very worried about the pilotless planes or single pilot operations and commercial planes in a decade or two. At least those are the predictions of experts. And since you're an airline pilot, you would know whether your job can be replaced by some computer. What do you think? Should I be worried? Looking forward to hearing from you. Thank you, Vlad. I think we might see some pilotless airplanes in some operations other than passenger carrying operations, perhaps cargo shipments, etc., but not in Part 121 scheduled air carrier operations. I just do not see it happening. Do not be afraid. There will be plenty of jobs out there for people like us that have the skills, mad skills, to do it. So, no, I don't think. Now, there are some people that would argue with me and say, no, 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 Jeff, in 2-3 decades, every flight that anybody takes is going to be on a completely automated airplane and no pilots. I say, nope, I do not believe it. Just not going to happen. All right, moving on to Philip Lopasser. Lopasser. I don't know. He didn't give me a phonetic pronunciation of his name. So we're just going to say Philip. He writes, hopefully this is good feedback material for the next APG episode. Yeah, it is. I was doing my bi-weekly late night meandering around the web for aviation news and found this tidbit. We recently had a Navy UAV make a little cross-country journey. Sent me a link to aviationanalysis.net. And it talks about the MQ-4C Triton completes its maiden cross-country flight. And let's see. I was wondering if the FAA would inform the airlines the UAV cross-country was taking place. What do you think? I'm sure if they did put the word out, it would be on a need-to-know basis. What do you think? I don't know if they told the airlines about this or not. Let's see. He says, thanks so much for doing this. I'm down here at Shepherd until Thanksgiving and then heading back to Charlotte. Just want to share that. APG is the highlight of my week, and I kind of feel like we're all family. Yeah, I do too, Phil, really. So in all seriousness, thanks. Well, in all seriousness, Philip, I appreciate you out there listening and sending in feedback and all that kind of stuff. It truly is a community, and it's not my show. It's all of our show, really. So I read this, he did. I'm sorry, Philip. Now, finally, I look at the end of his email and he says, he does phonetically spell it out. It's Lopasser, emphasis on the L, Lopasser. Okay. So I take it back, Philip. You did actually give me the phonetic help and I still screwed it up. Sorry. Okay, the U.S. Navy MQ-4C Triton UAV is made by Northrop Grumman. It's basically the sister or brother or whatever of the, one that we have been using for a while? Okay, come on, try to find it. Oh, the U.S. Air Force RQ-4B Global Hawk, except that it has reinforcements to the airframe and wing along with de-icing and lightning protection systems. And this thing can get up to 18 kilometers, which is about 59,000 feet. And this cross country started in Palmdale, California, flew along the Mexican-U.S. border, then out over the Gulf of Mexico, and then up the eastern coast up to, Patuxent. And they were, for most of that time, it was up at 50,000 feet. So it wasn't going to bother any airliners out there. There are no scheduled airliners up flying up at 50,000 feet. So that might be one reason why, you know, they didn't bother telling the airlines, because they knew that it wasn't going to be a problem except for climbing and descending. So, yeah, pretty cool system. There's a lot more to read about if you want to. And I'll have a link to this article in the show notes. Pretty cool. Private pilot Arno sent in some feedback. Let's listen to him. He's from Paris.
Hello, Captain Jeff. This is private pilot Arno from Paris, France. I have just a short feedback about Mayday and Pan Pan. In fact, I was wondering where those words were coming from, and in fact I found out that Mayday comes from the French word Mayday, which means help me. So Mayday is actually the English pronunciation of the French word m'aider, which means help me. So it's quite relevant, and it's quite self-explaining. And also the word pan, in fact, in French, pan means a break or a breakdown. So in fact, again, it's self-explaining that when you say in English pan, in fact, it means in French there is something broken down in the airplane. So it's quite funny that language, the international language, English, is using two old French words to explain critical situation. Okay, so that's it for my short feedback. I wish you qu'à vous, to you.
Oui, magnifique. I probably didn't do that right. Thank you very much, Arnaud, for sending in the feedback, and I have to be honest with you, I started doing research on Mayday and Pan and trying to find somebody to pronounce Mayday, whatever, and then I finally listened to your feedback and went, oh gosh, you did all the research and pronunciation for me. So, wow, I wasted a lot of time on that, but not really. It was interesting research. Found a Wikipedia article about May Day and the history of it, which you did not touch upon, but it is interesting that that the May Day call is the French word May Day, and means help me. So when you say May Day, you're saying help me. The procedure word originated in 1923 by Frederick Stanley Mockford, a senior radio officer at Croydon Airport in London. Mockford was asked to think of a word that would indicate distress and would easily be understood by all pilots and ground staff in emergency, since much of the traffic at the time was between Croydon and La Bourget Airport in Paris. He proposed the word Mayday from the French Mayday, meaning come help me, or Venez Mayday, meaning come help me. Before the voice call, Mayday, SOS, was the Morse code equivalent of the Mayday call. In 1927, the International Radio Telegraph Convention of Washington adopted the voice call Mayday in place of the SOS Morse code call. The Mayday was defined as corresponding to the French pronunciation of the expression Mayday. Okay, so there we go. And then, as you mentioned, pan, or pan, means pan, broke in French. So very interesting. I love trying to figure out the origin of words and other phrases and things. And it's interesting. I'm glad you asked and answered the question, Arnaud, for us. And thanks again for listening. And please do send some more audio feedback in the future. Definitely enjoyed that. And cavu to you, and he put in his text. In French, we say cavoque. Yeah, I've seen that as well. CAVOK, which means ceiling and visibility okay. It's good. Okay. All right. Dan Colucci writes, Pan Am experience. Thought you'd enjoy. He just sent me a link to a consumerist.com article, but then I went directly to the actual source of all this. And there's a company in Hollywood called the Pan Am Experience. Pan Am flies again. From its birth in 1927, Pan American Airways was a pioneer airline whose routes spanned six continents and more than 80 countries. Almost a century later, the name Pan Am is still a very powerful brand. And inside this Southern California, hang on, I got to make sure that I do something here before my video is interrupted. Okay. And inside the Southern California Motion Picture Studio sits an exact replica of the airline's Boeing 747 and everything that made it so special. Okay, we're still recording. Good. Your Pan Am experience starts on the main deck with a fun cocktail hour and a beverage service where guests can explore and mingle about in the cabin. Each stewardess that greets you will be adorned in an original 1970s Pan Am uniform. Our Pan Am crew will offer various video and audio selections while you sit back in your Pan Am sleeperette seat for main deck passengers or upper deck lounge seats for the upper deck passengers and enjoy the company of your fellow travelers. Soon after that, the crew will set your table for a truly memorable dining event. In classic Pan Am style, you'll be served a delightful gourmet meal. Everything from the china to the glassware is authentic, with careful attention to the exquisite service delivery of the era and menu offerings of Pan Am. After dinner, you'll have an opportunity to view the vast collection of airline memorabilia and view other film production sets. For the first time since Pan Am ceased operations, you can now relive the magic of this golden era in travel. We cordially invite you to personally experience this unique flying opportunity in the tradition of Pan Am. So, I'll have a link to that in the show notes. If you're out in Hollywood and you want to experience the Pan Am experience, check it out. I think the tickets are about the price of a airline ticket, you know, for domestic or first class. So, it sounds like you get a nice meal and get to flirt with the pretend stewardesses. There you go. Let's see. Chattanooga, Tim wrote me and said, "Hey, how many Tims do we have?" And I wrote back and I said, "Way too many." Just kidding. He says, "Yo, yo, Captain Jeff, what is the best 1-second comment that sums up a good flight given to the captain or first officer by a passenger while deplaning?" He says, "Nailing a landing is a source of pride for pilots, but when I say a genuine nice landing, I think that the remark more often than not is taken as a sarcastic comment from some jerk or from some jerk. Should I skip the nice landing and just go with great flight? Thanks, I'll be back. Or nice save on the struts, brakes, and tires with a big thumbs up. No, don't do that one. Or is there a way of saying, no, I swear, I mean really, a great landing. All in 1 to 2 seconds on the way out to the jet bridge?" So I wrote back, I said, just say like, you know, hey, great flight, nice landing or something like that. And we're going to not think that you're being a sarcastic jerk. So, and it's always appreciated when people mention that because we really do try hard to get the best landing we can. So, I mean, if it really is a nice landing, now, if you're really pranging it on, don't say nice landing because then he'll think you're definitely being sarcastic. Get out of here. All right. So, all that being said, which member of the flight deck does the dog and pony show? We know that you, the APG, likes to interact with the passengers, but usually is it the pilot flying the landing or the pilot not flying? And the answer to that question is usually the person that you hear. This is, you know, not really a set in cement or concrete rule, but in general, I think that for most air carriers, the person that you are hearing, at least during the flight, is usually the person that is the pilot monitoring, not the pilot flying. But you know me, I like yakking. I like talking on the interphone. And so I usually, unless I'm flying with somebody that I know for sure really does a nice job with PAs, I usually say, "Hey, do you mind if I do the PAs? Because I really like talking to the passengers." And they usually go, "Oh, yeah, yeah, no problem." But in general, it's the captain's responsibility, but he may delegate that responsibility for doing, he will not delegate the responsibility, but he may delegate the performance or the duty of speaking on the PA system to one of the other crew members. Again, I like talking, so I do it most of the time. So there's really no surefire way to know, you know, who's talking and who's flying, whatever. So there you have it. That's Chattanooga Tim. He says, "Afraid of blue ice from above." And you should be, Tim. Okay, let's see. Chris writes, "This feedback is with regards to the ongoing discussion about automation in the cockpit. There are two longer articles that take deeper, there are two longer articles that take deeper looks into this issue. This one from the New Yorker by Maria Konnikova writes, it's called The Hazards of Going on Autopilot. And He says, focuses on research on what automation does to pilot attention and active monitoring. I think you'll be interested in this angle as it might tie into the feedback request for research into cockpits and automation, which is referred to in the article, and how system designers in both aviation and the looming Google car automation future are thinking. And here's a quote from the article. What we're doing is using human beings as safety nets or backups to computers, and that's completely backward. It would be much better if the computing system watched us and chimed in when we did something wrong. Absolutely true. Yeah, it's all about, and I've talked about this before, the thing that they really have to figure out is that interface between, you know, man and machine, human and computer. And because, you know, automation is doing such great things, but it's also taking us out of the whole thing. And in an ironic way, is actually making things more dangerous, possibly. So that's what they have to figure out. Let's see. And you'll recognize this name from your dog-eared copy of Stick and Rudder by the author's father. This is a deep dive into the Air France disaster. And this is the article from Vanity Fair, Air France Flight 447 crash. And this is, again, from Chris. Well, maybe I didn't tell you who that was from. Chris. And, yeah, I think they were both good articles. The first one in the New Yorker by Maria Kornikova. The only thing I think I mentioned this on a previous show, was that, one of these paragraphs, I forgot where she talked about the guy flying Colgan, 3407, grabbing the shaker, you know, there was a stick shaker and stick pusher, and she said that he was grabbing the shaker. Well, it's not a shaker, but other than that, here it is. In his panicked confusion, he pulled the shaker toward him instead of pushing it away from him. not quite. Anyway, otherwise, though, a good article, and as was the Flight 447, which every time I read, you know, the stuff about 447 and what exactly happened and the conversation that they're having, and it just kind of makes me feel sick to my stomach. It's just like, you know what the outcome is, and you're going, come on, don't you see what's happening here? You're crashing a perfectly good airplane. But anyway, I'll put both of those links in the show notes, and you can take a look at them as well. Thank you, Chris, for sending those. Craig Messerman from Missoula, Montana, Big Sky Country, sent a couple pictures. He says, these photos are from Two Rivers State Park, Montana, about 30 miles east of the Alberton Gorge, where a shipment of 737s derailed in June. The canyon here funnels low VFR traffic east out of Missoula and is almost on a straight line from Chicago to Seattle. So along with the Northern Pacific Railway and I-90, it's 24-hour planes, trains, and automobiles, with occasional planes on trains. And so this picture depicts a train and the rail cars with the 737 fuselages on them, not in the gorge somewhere, derailed. That's pretty cool. And this wide picture shows four of the fuselages going by in this, the gorge, the Alberton Gorge. Pretty cool, I say. Thank you, Craig, for sending that to me. The Big Sky High School in Missoula. Frick sent me some audio feedback. Let's hear what Frick has to say.
Hi, Captain Jeff. Frick from South Africa. Decided I'll do some audio feedback this time. And my question is regarding the Hoxha incident with the TBM. Now, I'm totally not an expert on planes. Never flown one myself. But would I be wrong to think that planes that is capable of flying those altitudes comes with autopilot? And how difficult would it be to install a type of monitoring system for the quality of the oxygen in the cabin in cases where the pilot becomes incapacitated, where the system will pick up on that and send out an automated declaration of an emergency and immediately start to descend to a altitude where the levels are safe again. By that, you know, where it doesn't rely on the pilot or the pilot's cognitive ability to operate the pilot, just to bring the plane back into a safe situation where everything is okay again. Your thoughts on that? Thank you for the show, and kavu to you.
Kavu to you, and thank you. Sorry about the, I don't know what happened to the audio there, a couple little places there where it kind of broke up a little bit, but we got the gist of what you're saying. And, you know, I don't think there's a requirement for an autopilot system at that altitude. I mean, I think above, anytime you get into the reduced vertical separation, the RVSM altitudes above 29,000 feet and above, or maybe it's above 29,000 feet. In other words, you know, up in the 30s and 40s, you do. In fact, you're not allowed to be up there unless you have an autopilot that's actually working. And if you're up there and your autopilot stops working, then you have to descend to non-RVSM altitudes. But below that, I don't think there is any specific requirement, but I bet that most airplanes that are operating up in that altitude range, you know, above in the class A class A airspace here in the United States above 18,000 feet, most airplanes I do think are equipped. Now I know there are some regional airlines like or airliners like the Jetstreams and that kind of thing that don't have autopilots installed. I know there's some others as well, and they fly in those altitudes, so not necessarily a requirement, but I'm not sure, but I'd say that most of them are equipped with autopilots, and that's an interesting idea, Frick. Never thought of that. You know, have some kind of a system. I'm not sure how expensive it would be, but you know, some kind of an oxygen monitor, because you know you can find those things that clip to your fingers and tell you what your oxygen level is in your bloodstream. So I'm sure there's a way to. Well, of course there is. To have some kind of a sensor up in the cockpit that senses ambient oxygen or the partial pressure of oxygen. Once it blows or falls below a certain threshold, it does some kind of a warning. And then after a certain amount of time, the pilots don't respond to it, then it automatically sends out a distress signal, you know, squawks emergency and descends and that kind of thing. I don't know. That's interesting. Maybe somebody's already thought of that. Maybe people are working on that kind of system, but if something like that was installed on the TBM 900, that guy would probably still be, he and his wife would still be with us. Interesting, Frick. Maybe you should hurry over there and patent this thing. You know, maybe make some big money. Interesting thought. Derek writes, another classic case of media sensationalism. What? Southwest Airlines operating flight 1704 from Sacramento to Burbank made an emergency high-speed landing at LAX due to flap failure. Of course, the writer wants to report that it was a full cruise speed landing. No. I'm enclosing a few links. According to the Aviation Herald, the touchdown was 174 knots, which is pretty fast. And he has a link to an LA Times article on the incident and FlightAware article on that as well. The FlightAware link does show the flight tracking and a link to the Aviation Herald, which seems to be more neutral in its reporting. I got a laugh at the reporting. I don't know the ultimate cause of the flap trouble and I hope it's not a maintenance deficiency, but sounds like the flight crew responded appropriately. Yeah, they did. Anytime you have a situation with the flaps, you get into the expanded procedures, and then you know you determine what you're going to have for landing, and in almost every case, anytime you're limited to the flaps available, you want a long runway because that means you're going to have to fly faster. Because the reason why we have flaps is not to slow the airplane down; it's so that we can fly the airplane more slowly. And why do we want to do that? Just, I know you all know, but just in case somebody's listening who is new to this whole thing, when you extend flaps on a wing, you change the shape of the wing and make the wing produce more lift at lower speeds. Lower speeds means that when you're landing, you have a lot less energy, and you don't want to have a lot of energy when you're landing, because then the brakes and the reverse thrust and everything else has to work against or dissipate all the energy. And, you know, the faster you're going, the harder it is to stop. So, you know, like, what is it? Kinetic energy equals mass times velocity squared. So anytime that V, the velocity part of that equation, moves up, gets higher, the more the energy you have in an exponential way. So that's the reason why we have flaps. And Southwest Airlines plane made an emergency landing Saturday at Los Angeles International Airport after the plane's flaps malfunctioned. It was supposed to land at Bob Hope Airport in Burbank, but it's not a very long runway there. So they decided to go to Los Angeles International with the long runway, which is exactly what we would all do. Paul Mitchell said the pilot announced that there was a problem with the flaps and the plane circled the Burbank Airport before landing at the longer international runway at LAX. "We came into LAX so low and so fast, it was eerie," said Mitchell, the vice president of Political Data Incorporated, a self-described frequent flyer. "We landed almost at full speed." Don't think so. So, there's that. Yes, well, anytime it comes to an incident with an airplane or a flight, and it involves the media that doesn't really usually know that much about what's going on, it's likely to be sensationalized. So thank you, Derek, for that. Mike Dell writes, "I saw this aircraft parked on the general aviation ramp at KTVC, I think that's Traverse City, at lunch. It was about a mile away, so I couldn't get the tail number. It's basically unmarked. The only thing I can think of is that it's the Red Wings Detroit hockey team aircraft. They're up in Traverse City this week for training camp." And then he sent me another one. He goes, "The last pick was not the Red Wings plane, at least not their normal one. Here's a picture of the one they use, which is a DC-9. And then he sent back yet another one. These are all in short order. "Okay," he said, "Google is your friend. I found it. It's their new aircraft. They still need to repaint it. There was a news story about it and a picture. It's going to be called Redbird 3. And it's a Mad Dog, an MD-81, I believe. And there's a link here that I'll include in the show notes. There's one of the media outlets, or NHL.com somewhere. They interviewed the captain on it. He's been a captain or a pilot for the Detroit Red Wings private airplane since, I think, 1988. So 26 years. And so it's pretty cool. So I'll put the link there in the show notes if you want to check it out. So thank you, Mike. I'm glad that you got it figured out. And by the way, Mike is, at first I thought this was, he's trying to give me some kind of a hint, and it says, "Learn to podcast or improve your podcast. The podcast help desk." But then I remembered after I went to that link, podcasthelpdesk.com, that Mike, that's his podcast. He does a show about helping people learn how to podcast or improve their podcast. So check it out if you're thinking about doing something like this. Sam Franklin writes, "Regarding international commuters, a friend of our family is a senior captain on the Airbus 380, the A380, for an Asian airline, and he lives back here in northern UK and commutes out for flights. Just thought I'd let that listener know, quite an extreme case." And then he adds, if you ever happen to be in the UK, I know it's unlikely. My job is making coffee, so it's definitely on me. Oh, yeah. Thank you, Sam. I'll definitely take you up on that. Chris Olson writes, "Greetings, sir. It's been a while. You were kind enough to take my bingo fuel." Oh, okay. Never mind. I didn't mean to read this one. Chris Olson, Captain Chris Olson, he's a developer, an app developer, and he, you might remember me talking about the Bingo Fuel app. that he created, and he just now created an iPad version, and he sent me a link to that. So I'm gonna download it and play with it, and I'll let you know what I think about it on the next show. How about that? He sent me a link for that, and might be kind of useful for those of you listening to the show who happen to be pilots. So thank you, Chris, for that. This one I do intend to read. This is from Tim Van Ram. And hope you don't mind, because the show is not going to be that long. I only have, believe it or not, this is amazing. After this piece of feedback, I only have three more. And no, well, maybe only two more. And then the show is over. It's going to be a short show. I'm making history, I think. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and read this. And this was really interesting, so please listen. Maybe you've seen this before in your email, but I had not, and I thought it was amazing. So here are two stories, and both of them are true. And listen on, because it will have a link or a relation to aviation, okay? Two stories, both true. Story number one. Many years ago, Al Capone virtually owned Chicago. Capone wasn't famous for anything heroic. He was notorious for enmeshing the Windy City in everything from bootlegged booze and prostitution to murder. Capone had a lawyer nicknamed Easy Eddie. He was Capone's lawyer for a good reason. Eddie was very good. In fact, Eddie's skill at legal maneuvering kept Big Al out of jail for a long time. To show his appreciation, Capone paid him very well. Not only was the money big, but Eddie got special dividends as well. For instance, he and his family occupied a fenced-in mansion with live-in help and all of the conveniences of the day. The estate was so large that it filled an entire Chicago city block. Eddie lived the high life of the Chicago mob and gave little consideration to the atrocity that went on around him. Eddie did have one soft spot, however. He had a son that he loved dearly. Eddie saw to it that his young son had clothes, cars, and a good education. Nothing was withheld. Price was no object. And despite his involvement with organized crime, Eddie even tried to teach him right from wrong. Eddie wanted his son to be a better man than he was. Yet, with all his wealth and influence, there were two things he couldn't give his son. He couldn't pass on a good name or a good example. One day, Easy Eddie reached a difficult decision. Easy Eddie wanted to rectify wrongs he had done. He decided he would go to the authorities and tell the truth about Al Scarface Capone, clean up his tarnished name, and offer his son some semblance of integrity. To do this, he would have to testify against the mob, and he knew that the cost would be great, so he testified. Within the year, Easy Eddie's life ended in a blaze of gunfire on a lonely Chicago street. But in his eyes, he had given his son the greatest gift he had to offer, at the greatest price he could ever pay. Police removed from his pockets a rosary, a crucifix, a religious medallion, and a poem clipped from a magazine. The poem read, "The clock of life is wound but once, and no man has the power to tell just when the hands will stop at late or early hour. Now is the only time you own. Live, love, toil with a will. Place no faith in time, for the clock may soon be still." Story number two. World War II produced many heroes. One such man was Lieutenant Commander Butch O'Hare. He was a fighter pilot assigned to the aircraft carrier Lexington in the South Pacific. One day, his entire squadron was sent on a mission. After he was airborne, he looked at his fuel gauge and realized that someone had forgotten to top off his fuel tank. He would not have enough fuel to complete his mission and get back to his ship. His flight leader told him to return to the carrier. Reluctantly, he dropped out of formation and headed back to the fleet. As he was returning to the mothership, he saw something that turned his blood cold. A squadron of Japanese aircraft was speeding its way toward the American fleet. The American fighters were gone on a sortie, and the fleet was all but defenseless. He couldn't reach his squadron and bring them back in time to save the fleet, nor could he warn the fleet of the approaching danger. There was only one thing to do. He must somehow divert them from the fleet. Laying aside all thoughts of personal safety, he dove into the formation of Japanese planes. Wing-mounted 50 calibers blazed as he charged in, attacking one surprised enemy plane and then another. Butch wove in and out of the now broken formation and fired at as many planes as possible until all his ammunition was finally spent. Undaunted, he continued the assault. He dove at the planes, trying to clip a wing or a tail in hopes of damaging as many enemy planes as possible, rendering them unfit to fly. Finally, the exasperated Japanese squadron took off in another direction. Deeply relieved, Butch O'Hare and his tattered fighter limped back to the carrier. Upon arrival, he reported in and related the event surrounding his return. The film from the gun camera mounted on the plane told the tale. It showed the extent of Butch's daring attempt to protect his fleet. He had, in fact, destroyed 5 enemy aircraft. This took place on February 20, 1942, and for that action, Butch became the Navy's first ace of World War II and the first naval aviator to win the Congressional Medal of Honor. A year later, Butch was killed in aerial combat at the age of 29. His hometown would not allow the memory of this World War II hero to fade, and today, O'Hare Airport in Chicago is named in tribute to the courage of this great man. So the next time you find yourself at O'Hare International, give some thought to visiting Butch's memorial displaying his statue and his Medal of Honor. It's located between Terminals 1 and 2. So what do these two stories have to do with each other? Well, Butch O'Hare was Easy Eddie's son. And now you know the rest of the story. I loved Paul Harvey, news and commentary, and the rest of the story. Thank you, Tim Van Ram, for sending that email and the two stories and how the father gave the ultimate, or made the ultimate sacrifice to save his son from, you know, a life of whatever. You know, he gave his son his good name and taught him right from wrong, and certainly did a good job, didn't he? Okay, thank you. Brian sent me some audio feedback. Let's hear what Brian has to say.
Hello, Captain Jeff. This is Brian from Katy, Texas. It's been a while since I left voice feedback. Since you've been having plenty of feedback, I haven't had a need to ask any other questions. But had an experience that I thought that I found interesting. I flew a 787 from Houston, George Bush, to San Francisco this past Monday morning, and had a window seat and was looking forward to looking out the windows along the way. Sometime after we reached the probably the 10,000 foot level where they had the double ding saying your personal devices could be used, all of a sudden all the windows went dark. If you're aware of the, I'm sure you're aware of the 787, they have, they don't have window shades on the windows. They have a mechanism that you push a button and it dims the window or lightens up the window so you could control how much light comes through. Well, like I was saying, it went all the way to the dark side, and it bothered me at first because I was watching a movie and wasn't really concerned. And later on the flight, I wanted to gaze out the window, see where we're going, see what's going on outside, and tried to undim it, and the controls were disabled. And while it wasn't totally opaque, it was very dark, and you could see very little details of the ground because it was so dark. So it was really kind of disconcerting that I couldn't control my window anymore. And then sometime as we were going down, descending into San Francisco, the windows all lightened up and there was control again. So apparently the pilots have the ability to, or I don't know if it's the pilots or the flight deck, a flight crew, the flight attendants have the ability to disable the controls of the windows to make it all dark so that you don't have one person that's open the window up and letting light in and ruin everybody's movie experience, I guess. But doesn't mean I really don't like it. I just thought I'd pass that along. Have a good day.
Do you have a bird or is that your phone? Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Mozisik. I don't know how you pronounce your last name. Sorry, Brian. Thank you for telling us about those. You know, I'd read in articles about the ability for those windows to, you know, change opacity based on, I don't know, electric charges or something. I'm not sure exactly how it works, but maybe LCDs or I don't know. But regardless, I had no idea that somebody had the ability to, like the child lock in your car, right, or the window lock, where you have a master control and then, you know, your kids can't roll the windows up and down in the back, or maybe like a child lock on the doors in the back of your car. I guess that's what they have for these windows on the 787, which kind of bites, I think, especially, you know, if you're an aviation enthusiast and you spend all this money to fly and you have a window seat, I mean, you know, might want to look outside and enjoy the view. So I'm pretty sure it's probably not the pilots in the cockpit that have that control. It's probably, as you surmised, the flight attendants have some kind of a control over those, master control over the windows. And yeah, that would be, you know what? If enough people complain about it, maybe they'll put out some kind of a memo to the cabin crews and say, hey, don't do that. You know, let the passengers control the lights of the windows, or the opacity or transparency of the windows. So interesting. Interesting, interesting. Thank you, Brian, for sending that in. And finally, David ends the feedback on this show with this. He said, hi, Captain Jeff. Greetings from Greenville, South Carolina. I'm listening to episode 135, and something you said surprised me a bit. You mentioned that the autoflight systems, on the Mad Dog anyway, and I think on most airplanes, that is, do not control rudder input during maneuvers except during low-speed phases such as approach. If this is the case, how does the autopilot keep its turns coordinated? Dave, thank you. Oh, he says, as always, clear skies, favorable winds, and the next time you lay over at GSP, beers are on me. I like it. Okay, Dave, we'll do that. So that's a very, very good question. And the answer to this question is that these big transport category airplanes have a system on the rudder that is called the yaw damper or yaw dampen. I've heard it referred to as yaw damper and yaw dampener. Essentially, it's a system that automatically actuates ever so slightly the rudder to compensate for any adverse yaw. Okay, so it's kind of like kind of a subconscious autopilot system. It's not an active autopilot system. It's just kind of there to, you know, when we bank the airplane and the rudder system goes, oh, I'm experiencing some yaw. They must have some accelerometers or something back there, or maybe it's some kind of a direct mechanical linkage or mechanical formula that once, you know, you sense this amount of bank, it's going to put in this. I don't know how it works, obviously, but it's not directly related to the autopilot system, but it does compensate. So essentially when you're flying, you know, jet transport aircraft, you don't really need to use the rudder. So when I'm banking the airplane, I'm hand flying the airplane, the rudder is automatically compensating and making it a coordinated turn. The only time you really need to have your feet on the rudder pedals for a jet transport category airplane is for your takeoff and initial climb. And then, you know, coming in, you know, the latter stage of your approach and landing. And that's it. Because, you know, you may need to put in some rudder to align the fuselage with the runway, et cetera. You know, you definitely don't have your feet flat on the floor for that. But every other part of the operation of the flight is, you know, you could have your feet flat on the floor and not touching the rudder pedals because that yaw damper is doing the job. So yeah, it's a very useful, critical component. In fact, when we lose the yaw damper, we're usually limited to certain speeds and certain altitudes because it's just dangerous to operate without it. And it helps to compensate for Dutch roll and other things that could happen with the airplane. So that's what does it. It's the yaw damper that coordinates the turns for us. So pretty cool system. And again, I guess you could call it kind of like a sub autopilot. It's not really something that you actively use, but it happens. It's working on its own back in the back. And that's about all I can tell you about the yaw damper system or yaw dampeter system. But that's what does it. So that is it. I think that we are finished with the show. Now, if you want to find out more about the show, about me and the Airline Pilot Guy community, head over to airlinepilotguy.com. There you'll find information on the coffee fund, how to contact me, other methods of listening / watching the show, and previous episodes, etc. So check it out. Again, airlinepilotguy.com. And until next time, I'm hoping you have a great week, a great weekend. See you back here on the next episode of the Airline Pilot Guy Show. Until then, clear skies and limited visibility and tailwinds. Take care and God bless.
Good day.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.